I must say it's going to be probably awkward to give a real lecture with, you know, a sort of intimate group of people, so please ask me questions. And in the spirit of what Gord was saying yesterday, I know that there's no need to go through everything that's there. So I think the whole talk is chunked, so we could stop at any point. And also, I'm spending actually quite a lot of time, I don't know, blathering on about introduction to the olfactory system. And many of you were here, some of you, at least the theorists, were here for Rainer Friedrich's talk, and I don't know Ben Strobich's talk much about olfaction. But I figured a lot of the experimental audience wasn't there, and it's worth hearing some of the things again, and maybe a complimentary view of things. Forgive me if things are repetitive. It's better to be repetitive than to be obscure. Okay, so my lab works on. I know this is not a formal talk, but I just want to acknowledge the people who did, and I think today the actual experimental stuff was actually quite a huge part of it was driven by an incredible graduate student in my lab, Florin Albiano. His first name is really Dino, but he goes by Florin, who is now actually, just as of last week, was promoted to assistant professor at Cold Spring Harbor. He went there as a fellow, and I'm very, very happy to see that they seem to like him, and so he did a huge chunk of the work. And so a couple of the current, and this is a biophysics student who built essentially every equipment, every piece of electronics, hardware, and whatnot in the lab, so it was also wonderful to have him and a few other people. Okay, so I'm standing this way just because most of the people are there, but I'm going to have to cross and block the thing. Maybe I'll try to move this. This might be wise. Okay, great. Okay, I picked this up from the Wikipedia. It seems like you can get pretty much any slide from Wiki now, just because I think it's kind of cool and to remind ourselves that how potentially insignificant olfaction is to humans, although I don't believe so. So this is, you have the receptor neurons in the nasal epithelium, and effectively, the purpose of the air going in is to feed your body oxygen, and it turns out that in volatile odors are in there, some of it flows over the nasal epithelium, presumably turbulently, and activates the neurons, sensory neurons in the epithelium, who send their axons through the bony plate, the cribriform plate, and make synapses into the olfactory bulb directly. And the olfactory bulb is a pretty small structure relative to the rest of the brain in humans, but it's quite a significant part of the brain for many other mammals and many other vertebrates. Some of the things that we already know is that the olfactory bulb then directly sends projections to many areas in the limbic cortex, including piriform cortex, amygdala, and so on. But what we study is actually the mouse olfactory system for, I suppose, partly historical reasons, because mouse is a great genetic animal. But in this particular case, it also makes ethological sense because mice and other rodents do rely on olfaction for quite a lot of things when they're born. They pretty much have distal. The only distal sense they rely very heavily on olfaction for distal sensing. For proximal, of course, they have the whisker system because audition and vision are really poorly developed until about 2 weeks. So the chemical senses, as they're loosely called, certainly in the mouse and other rodents, has sort of many seems to have divisions. This is the main olfactory epithelium, which senses the volatile odorants, just as I showed you from the human drawing. But there's also the pheromone system, which is the vomeronasal organ, which is thought to detect what you would call pheromones, although that definition is becoming fuzzier by the day. But these typically are not so much volatile. They are more contact-driven, at least that's what it's thought. And then there is the so-called Grunberg ganglion, which has, I think, a very small number of cells, just a few hundred cells. And these guys are right, it's almost like a tip sensor, like something like a pitot sensor in your airplane or something, which senses something. And there is some recent evidence showing that maybe it's some sort of an alarm pheromone. It's sort of a signaling system that detects something really bad. But anyway, that's another thing. And then there's also the septal organ. There are a few other things which sense specialized things. And in general, the main olfactory epithelium, the main olfactory system, is thought to be the generalized sensor. It's sort of a learned odor, and if you smell a perfume that you've never smelled before, that the main olfactory system is the one that's going to make sense of that. Again, the axons are sent to the olfactory bulb, the main olfactory bulb, which is quite big relative to the rest of the brain in mice. And the organization, as you all probably know, in the epithelium, unlike many other sensory surfaces, the sensors that detect the odorants are laid out much more stochastically, seemingly. This is an old drawing, and it shows four different zones, and this is almost certainly wrong. There are about 1,000 kinds of receptors in mice. Each neuron expresses one out of these 1,000. So you can think of, essentially, instead of three pigments in the retina, you have, you know, 1,000 of these things. Any particular receptor, any particular type of receptor, is expressed scattered in a zone, which is true from this drawing. But what is not true is it's not that there are four specific zones. Basically, you have an overlapping continuous distribution. So if you have one receptor A, would occupy the zone somewhat stochastically, as far as we can tell. Another one would occupy a very overlapping, and it would sort of transition smoothly, right? So this zone idea is simply that it's almost like you have a state code for each receptor, and there may be whatever number, but they're all completely overlapping boundaries. They're not very clear. So what it means in terms of coding is that there are different receptors for detecting different odorants, but all the neurons that express a particular receptor are scattered in some fraction of the entire sheet. Let's say, you know, 20%, which is still a large number. So if you take a local region, you would find receptors, cells that express maybe 100 kind of receptors, 200 kind of receptors, all completely mixed up, right? Yep. Well, because it's a good question, and it's simply the fact that they used four receptors. They picked four receptors. This is Buck and Axel and others separately. And if you have, you know, three or four, you know, of course you would see patches. If you coincidentally pick two that happen to be overlapping, then you would say, oh, they're the same zone. If you found they were separate, you would see, right? It's a sampling problem, in other words. That's all. And there's a beautiful paper by Sakano's group, Hitoshi Sakano's group, which showed that clearly it's overlapping continuous distribution. And, you know, I wish somebody would write a nice review with that kind of figure so we can make that clear. Okay, so, and this makes intuitive sense that, you know, when odorants come in, it's very difficult for you to imagine that it'll deposit itself only in one part of that. It seems like it would be smoothly everywhere as a first approximation. So for receptors that detect a particular kind of odorant, you want them scattered around. So there's no reason to sort of put them in one. And but why they are in zones is unclear, but it has to do with perhaps the gene expression, because you have this very complicated way of expressing genes. Every neuron should express only one, but exclude all the others. So maybe there's just sort of tricks to sort of make this kind of a rule apply. Yeah? This is actually, we'll get to that. I mean, as soon as you start talking about the actual odor space, in my mind, it's all very confusing. There is evidence this way and that way, but whether or not evidence comes from a sampling problem, people just take the big space and just look what they read the tea leaves, essentially. And my own bias, and I think which there is evidence for supporting this bias, is that we don't actually quite understand if there's any organization. There are physics, or there are physical principles that would be important. For example, if you have a flow in sort of a confined area, you can sort of imagine that things that are smaller and more volatile would go farther than things that are more maybe hydrophobic and bigger. So people think maybe there is some gradient of molecular weight along that thing, or hydrophobicity, charge, and so on. But that's not the receptor necessarily. Okay? So this is and this is important in terms of, you know, thinking about coding only in the terms of, you know, when Chuck yesterday talked about retina and having sort of a map, you know, things continuously vary, you know, neighboring points have meaningful relationship in terms of the physical space. The olfactory system, I think, from the get-go, that seems very difficult to fathom, essentially. Yeah, go ahead. I'm not sure I understand, actually. I think I understand, but I don't know if I do. So if you take two different receptors, let's say two neurons contain two different receptors, you're saying it's somewhat they interact with each other there? No, I don't think so. Nothing known. There is no circuit in there. It's just cilia of these guys. They send their axons, as far as we can tell. Yeah. Okay, so, and then, of course, the most amazing thing, the discovery of the receptors, this family of receptors by Buck and Axel, as well as the following by, you know, them separately with Mombards and others, to show that all the neurons that express a particular receptor, receptor A, converge onto essentially two locations in the olfactory bulb, in these glomeruli. that was actually a pretty fundamental and spectacular discovery, right? So in other words, if this was just relayed on, it seems utter chaos. You have this, everybody spread on, but what you do is you take all of them and you make a particular address here, where this glomerulus now, which is in the dimension of about 80 microns in mice, would then, basically it's an identification for a particular receptor. Again, going from that to order space is again complicated because that depends on what the receptive field, if you will, of that particular G protein coupled receptor is. But at least you have a receptor atopic map here. Essentially, that's the, that would be the point. Yeah?
Is there any active control of the flow of
air? Absolutely. I mean, by sniffing.
Yeah, but that's just the pressure. Right? But is there any sort of
the
geometry of the nose change actively?
The internal thing turbinates, I don't think so. I don't think so. But I think the sniffing, you're saying it's not a, I don't think it's just a single dimensional thing. I think you can have the depth, the speed, and so on. So there is some, and this really seems like a fluid mechanics problem here, and then it would be interesting to study, I think. So.
Yep. There's a difference in the speed of the muscle, when you get responses to slower
using air. Right, so if you can maintain sort of a differential thing, presumably, yes. So. Yeah, that would be. And so for humans, we of course have the two nostrils are sort of connected way in the back, so you can get sort of internasal, internaris interactions of the flow, and then there's also the retronasal. When you chew food, like, you know, you're actually, the volatilized stuff actually goes back into your nose. So there's actually a very strong retronasal. But you're right. So whether or not you actively control, I mean, it seems like there's got to be something, but what exactly that, I don't know if it's been studied all that well. So, yeah.
So if all the
cellular
receptors reject to the same glomerulus,
yep.
If you lose that glomerulus by accident, would you lose that smell?
No. First of all, it's difficult to imagine why you would lose a glomerulus, because a glomerulus, there's no physical boundary in that, right? So you can make that a hypothetical question, of course. I think physically, I don't see how. But you still probably won't lose it, because a given order activates multiple receptors. Okay. So this is actually one fundamental piece. I think we can just go ahead and since you're asking the questions. What's known is that for all the receptors that have been, you know, people have attempted to look at, a given receptor responds with different affinities to a wide variety of odorants, sometimes in unpredictable ways. It's not that you can predict based on the molecular structure what. So essentially, you can, you know, think of it as three or four log units, even, right? I mean, we would have heard, you know, with this affinity, and similarly, a given the converse is that a given odor would bind to many different receptors with incredibly different KDs. So it's sort of spread out in a very big range. This is a question, and so this is one, for example, the psychophysics have done is people look at naturally occurring polymorphisms. Some people have a particular receptor is mutated or code-changed, and relating that to the perception of specific odorants. And this is done, I don't know, people are obsessed with this kind of sweat and all this kind of stuff, and people have said that there's, you know, polymorphisms in how, you know, something androsterone or whatever smells. So I you would imagine, but I would say that right now the evidence is more in general that things are distributed. Your point is like if something really dominates and very fine tuning, and there are not that many examples so far. Yeah. Correct. Actually, there are two on average per glomerulus, but a very small number. So there's two, it's almost, you can think of it as a mirror image represents, there's a one-to-one mapping, a receptor to a glomerulus, but that somehow is duplicated. In each bulb, there is a mirror symmetric sort of arrangement. It's repeated twice, but it's numerically, it's not exactly twice.
So that's a very misleading picture there, because in zone one, in the human type of receptors, there seem to be many
glomeruli. Right, that's right. The zone is missing. This, you're right. Zone one, the zones here should not really be bounded like this. That's right. So what you have to, I think what is true is that a given, like the red, would have a red glomerulus here, and then actually on the sort of, you know, there's a mirror symmetry. You can think of two locations within each glomerulus. Yes, that's right. Yep.
Good. The initial cells that contribute to dendrites to a given glomerulus.
Yes.
Is it known that those are all clustered in every phase?
Whether the mitral cell bodies are clustered? Yeah, it's not known, but it hasn't been exhaustively reconstructed, but they are. I'm getting to that next, actually. So they are, it's not exactly columnar, but they're kind of down below. So, Right. So I think I can put to the next slide because there is still more introduction to answer some of these questions. So this take chord. So within the bulb now, if you get to the actual circuits, you have the sensory neurons making standard axodendritic synapses under the glomerulus. The estimates of the number of these sensory cells of one particular type is somewhere between 10 to the 3 to 10 to the 4th. Nobody's counted exactly, but that's the order of magnitude. Each one makes about 8 synapses, so you can think of 8 times 10 to the 3 or 10 to the 4 or so synapses being made here. On to mitral cells, which are the principal cells. And again, just stereologically, just average calculations say that there are probably about 1 to 2 dozen of these mitral cells per glomerulus. Each mitral cell sends one apical dendrite to a single glomerulus. So it samples the excitatory central input from one. And the idea is that there is about a dozen of them. The more experiments are being done, it seems like the number is a little less than what people thought. Maybe it's close to a dozen of these. There are other kinds of principal cells called tufted cells, which are not shown here. Mitral cells are in a very nice layer. Tufted cells are sort of spread in the same numbers, but they're sort of loosely spread here. And then there's so-called external tufted cells, which are right in the periglomerular region, but they all do the same thing. Central glomerulus, they send the apical dendrite. Around the glomerulus, in certainly in the mammalian species, there are quite a variety of these periglomerular cells. And in fact, the variety of these interneurons here is pretty high. And Gord Fischel, in fact, had some studies looking at the interneuron diversity in this region. And whether or not it's going to be the same complication, same amount of numerically as in the cortex is unknown. But my feeling is that it's pretty diverse, and there's going to be interesting things going on here. And one unusual feature here, and it's not unusual in comparison to retina, which Bortend will hopefully tell you about, is that many of the synapses made in the glomerulus are dendrodendritic. So they're not this polarized. You have a neuron, axon, and making synapses on dendrites. They are dendrodendritic. For example, the mitral cells can release glutamate directly from their dendritic tufts. They receive glutamate inputs. They can spit out glutamate. These periglomerular cells can then spit out GABA. So there's a bit of a mess here, which I don't think the fact that they're dendrodendritic means that it's all sort of volume transmission. I think there's still specificity. You can think of them as point-to-point connections. But there's a lot of bidirectional communication here. The bottom line is that there seems to be a lot of intraglomerular processing going on. There is also some interglomerular processing where the so-called short axon cells, which in fact have long axons, they actually send their axons to many glomeruli, not all of them, but sort of seem to sample them to large distances, but in sort of sporadic manner. And there's people talk about small world networks and so on to give a physics analogy, but certainly there's connections between glomeruli. And the net polarity of these, this is wrong because originally there was some kind of a misleading paper. The direction is almost certainly inhibitory. These short axon cells probably inhibit, so it's interglomerular inhibition, if you will. But most of the processing, the interglomerular processing, is thought to occur deeper here, where these granule cells, these interneurons, which outnumber mitral cells 100 to 1. So this is inverted to the cortex, right? So there's a huge number of these guys, which make reciprocal synapses onto the mitral cells, leading to auto-inhibition as well as cross-inhibition across mitral cells. So this is the sort of synaptic. But what is in the retina, if you draw this, you will immediately say, oh, OK, there's lateral inhibition, Mexican hat, contrast enhancement, and so on and so forth. But the problem with the olfactory bulb is this kind of a drawing is a little bit misleading, because we actually don't know which mitral cell talks to which mitral cell here. Is this distance independent, distance dependent, isotropic, non-isotropic? None of this is actually known that well, which I'll get to in a second. But also, just for completeness sake, the main olfactory bulb sends, of course, inputs to cortical areas. There is no thalamus in olfaction, or at least directly. There's, you can get back in a circuitous route to thalamus. But they send inputs to multiple cortical areas. These are all anterior piriform cortex, subdivided into ventral and dorsal, posterior piriform cortex. There's entorhinal cortex. And I was disappointed to learn that this is not the entorhinal cortex that does the grid cells. This is some other kind of entorhinal cortex. And then there's the anterior olfactory nucleus, which is now going to be a cortical area. And it's a huge area, certainly in rodents. And it is the first place which essentially gets crossed input. So this projects all ipsilaterally, but the anterior olfactory nucleus our cortex projects back projections to both the bulbs, the ipsy and the contra. Therefore, a given anterior olfactory nucleus is effectively can sample both sides. And then the also cortical amygdala also gets a very nice input. And this is now people are beginning to be interested because it's a good way of doing all this fear and innate conditioning based on odors. And then for completeness sake again, to add to the confusion, essentially every one of these areas you have drawn sends back projection to the main olfactory bulb. So, So all of these areas then send feedback connections to this, which actually make the olfactory bulb very interesting to study because it's it's pretty much like the keyboard input to your computer, which is already receiving modulating input from the for the processor and so on. Okay, so some potentially unique. This is more of a way of discussion, and I'm sure that if you think hard, that your favorite sensory system also has these qualities. But just for discussion's sake, I want to put this up. So similar space, as we already talked about, it's pretty hard to quantify because it's not clear what axis to use, what metric. I mean, you can use concentration, that makes sort of sense. But in other cases, it's not clear. What should we do? Should we do the number of double bonds, number of carbon atoms, the presence of nitrogen, sulfide, so on and so forth. And then because of this, essentially, the topography in the odor space is very hard to define. So if you take a particular glomerulus now looking from top, what does neighborhood relationship here mean is sort of unclear. And then, as we talked about, there's active sampling, and this cheesy analogy I always give, you can walk by your favorite bakery or favorite fragrance shop, right? And you hold your breath, and you're almost certainly not going to smell anything. So you have to actively take it in, and you're not going to just by diffusion get enough molecules. So, and this active sampling is pretty, when you go, you smell something faint. Of course, we all see ourselves going. Right? I mean, and of course, animals, the rodents, certainly do this incredibly actively. So this seems to be a part of the thing. But yesterday and the day before, I was discussing with Botan about analogy with the retinal system. And I think Zach Manin, and I think other people have proposed years before too, that you can think of the sniff as more or less like a saccade in the retinal system, that you have, you sort of orient like a now. And then you do, and then there's a 200 millisecond or whatever, and then you do another one. And then there's this, as you talked about, this is top-down descending modulation, and you have the serotonergic fibers, the noradrenergic fibers, the cholinergic fibers, and the cortical areas, they all send feedback. In fact, the RAFE, the serotonergic input, comes strongly at the very first synapse in the glomerulus, and we had a paper recently which showed that the RAFE, which you would think as a very high-level kind of a midbrain structure, can affect the gain of the very first synapse coming into the olfactory bulb. So this feedback is presumably doing something interesting. Okay, and then to make this point, I mean, I like this table from Ken Sakamori's, one of his reviews, where you can see, okay, you have acids, all of these smell, and the acids, this is sort of the qualitative description of what, and you see, if you have, three carbons, pungent sour odor, and then you can all the way. Most of these seem to be kind of not so great from the description, right? But if you just diddle a little bit to make this into an alcohol, right, and you pretty much went from COOH to COH, and look, this all sounds good. So I find it amazing as first principles that you can make small changes, and of course, fundamentally, these changes. Of course, perfumers and people who thought about olfaction know this for a very long time, right? Given this, this is why it's kind of hard to imagine that how could you imagine an axis where you would just easily sort of plot simple things. And then, of course, there are complicated odors. Like if you have, I was actually yesterday, I was preparing for this, looking up on musk odor, which is a very, very common thing in male perfumes, perfumes for men and so on. That has a very complicated circular structure with lots of linear carbon chains. But apparently there are musk odors which are linear. They're like this. And the guess is that they somehow fold back on themselves in conformation in the receptor to create the musk kind of smell. But we don't know. And also, I was having a discussion with somebody. I remembered that there is a molecular weight above which things are just not vaporizable, so you don't smell them. And that number turns out to be about 300 molecular weight. So anything about 300 Daltons. And in fact, there's a specific number. Somebody said 294 is the largest thing you can sort of smell, humans can smell. And that makes physical sense. It has to do with the vapor pressure, I guess. Yes. Okay, so and then also this was kind of interesting when I was searching some time ago where people, this is from the biggest perfume company, Givaudan, which they were trying to synthesize a different, simpler patchouli odor or something, and this is apparently what they wanted, and there's this whole paper on synthesis, and I can't even read this. So, but it's, you know, it's, you can make very complicated molecules that are small and they smell kind of cool and interesting. Okay, again, in this. What's that? There's been a huge number of huge attempts, and we have to go back and look. And I have to say that I cannot paraphrase those because it's not, everybody has their way of describing it. And then there are attempts to take the human side. There is a small number of people who have many, many years ago taken a huge number of odorants and asked humans to classify them based on some measures, right? The measures are qualitative. But they attempt to make them quantitative by ranking them like 1 to 5 or something, like the smell lemony, you know, those sorts of things. So you have this psychophysical response to a large number of odors, very diverse odorants, ranked in many different parameters. And then people have tried to then do clustering and all sorts of unbiased things. And you always can explain some amount of the variance in the data. But I think the real thing is that the people who, of course, write something about it say, OK, we can explain X percent of the variance. But as a devil's advocate, you can come say that X is very small, so you're explaining hardly anything in the data. But there have been attempts, and very smart people have looked at it, and this is something I'm happy to discuss with you probably later. Okay, so again, some topics that might, you know, warrant attention, and many of these things that I think natural for thinking, I wouldn't say theoretically, but at least to think a bit more quantitatively and computationally. And this is the glomerular organization maps, how do you think of it? And then the logic of the bulbar circuits, which unfortunately I think is going to rely on this. So one idea is that by understanding the logic, which is sort of decipherable, you can maybe do reverse estimation of what, given this logic, what should it be, you know, capturing in the odor space. And then this whole idea, I think Reiner, I think, talked about this temporal dynamics and encoding, and this feedback modulation of processing, because people are interested very much in top-down control, how does attention change things? And then this, David, is, I put this on, David's not here, but there's also a small group of people, which we contributed a little bit of a study on this. It's a great place to do this coupling between blood flow and metabolic and metabolism, the coupling of neural activity to these things. The bulb seems to be a good model. And then going further down, you can certainly do very interesting things in cortical processing. It's, you can argue that it's different because the piriform cortex is a 3-layer cortex rather than the 5-layer cortex that, you know, many people study. But you know, you could sort of argue maybe this is more primitive. Understanding this is also interesting. Okay, my talk, I'll attempt to, these two are published. This is very recently, and this one was published about a year and a half ago, a collaboration with Marcus Meister's lab. I'll go through this very quickly just to orient you, spend some time. It doesn't matter if you don't get this because there's no, it's just methods at this point. So spatial organization or the map, right? And to answer your question, Rob, that the most influential set of studies or ideas came from Ken Sakamori's group. But they have said by using these ketones and simple molecules, but varying just the number of carbon atoms, going from, you know, acetaldehyde, I can't even think of the names of it, but all the way like a hepta, hexa, and so on, they just changed the number of, you know, carbon atoms for ketones, alcohols, and aldehydes. And they found that, at least in rat, that all the, if you give it different kinds of ketones, they seem to sort of occupy a smaller space in the bulb. If it's completely random, you would see scattered responses of all the glomeruli. Similarly for alcohols and aldehydes. So the idea is that there is preferential clustering of responding glomeruli to a particular class of molecules, right? But of course, you can say, like, in these are three kinds. What about the 100 other kinds? And we don't know the answer. But a strong version of this, if you now go microscopically within this region, so let's say there are 100 glomeruli here, that different chain length alcohols are actually represented in a smoothly varying manner. So you would have C5 next to C6 next to C7 and so on. Just like, you know, you would have, you know, different whiskers going along or retinals, right? So that was the strong version of this chemotopic idea that there is. And so you would say, like, you know, if this would imply that if you have, let's say, a C7 alcohol, this glomerulus responded strongly, the ones nearby should respond weakly and it should sort of fall off as distance. A C8 would then have a strong here, and so it would have sort of a smooth progression. So there's two different areas. One, this coarse there's just cluster, sort of more than chance, clustering of glomeruli that respond to a particular class of odorants. And then there's the fine scale structure within that region. So we recently set out to test the fine scale organization. And in particular, because the previous attempts really looked at these kinds of data at a much more gross level. They used methods like intrinsic imaging and even CFOS activity, which has a much coarser resolution than single glomeruli. Right? So we went back and looked carefully at single glomerular resolution, because you know this is the elemental unit, because it's one receptor, one glomerulus, to see if you just pick a huge number of odorants, as many as we could in a mouse experiment, chemically diverse, what can we make? Can we make sense of it? And this was done, the actual method just will take 2 seconds to explain. So this is a mouse that Peter Mommertz's group made, where they expressed a presynaptic activity marker in all olfactory sensory neurons. This marker is called synaptoflorin. It reports synaptic vesicle exocytosis. So all the axons are essentially sensitive. They are releasing transmitter. They're active and release transmitter. You would see increased fluorescence. So this is a mouse olfactory bulb, the two olfactory bulbs. You see individual glomeruli labeled. And this is a GFP-based probe invented by Gero Miesenbach, actually. And so we use this. We used a whole bunch of odorants dissolved at a particular concentration. So we picked 100 odorants based on things that are previously been shown to activate the dorsal surface, because you know, that's what we're looking at. So you need something, right? Anesthetize an animal, you know, make a little craniotomy, expose to olfactory bulb, and do simple fluorescence microscopy. And the signal is good enough, a lot of averaging in the glomerulus, so you can just do a very low resolution wide field microscopy over a large region. Or just to give you an idea that you picked, again, from literature, from us testing, like you would say, if somebody says, okay, ethylpropionate, we would then give it and make sure that you see something in the glomerular surface. Because the idea is that if you have no response in the surface, that's uninformative for what we're trying to do. And, you know, I wanted to take the time to put more, but just to show you that, you know, they're all small, but they're pretty diverse, and you have thiazoles and you know, nitrogen-containing and so on. So what do? Is you do this, and for each order, it's known, of course, from before. It's been actually well known. A given order would activate a few glomeruli. So a white spot is essentially a glomerulus that responded. We've thrown away all temporal information, because first of all, the probe is very slow, and we just have one scalar to say what is the magnitude of the response. And you can then give a lot of different orders, in this case, 98 odorants, and each odorant will give you a different response, and you can pick, let's say, 3 glomeruli, and then make a vector of the responses for that particular glomerulus. So you would get a vector of responses for glomerulus 1, 2, 3, and they would look like that. So you would have this glomerulus responded to 1, 2, 3, 4, right? Of course, we're just plotting delta F over F, so you can use some sort of an ROC analysis or something to say what is a response and so on. Yep. It's entirely confounding, right? But the only thing is that we would like to think it's an orthogonal dimension. So we're throwing it away, but it's not. It's hard to imagine why what we're saying here would affect just because I picked the wrong concentration. Right? You see what I mean? So it's in another dimension you would have to take into account. Yeah. They're not particularly high, so they are easily detectable. We happen to pick 1% weight per volume. In the dissolved thing, right? It's completely within the range, but I suspect for many of the odorants, so it depends on the odorant, right? For some odorants, the threshold is low. For many of the odorants, if I have to take a guess, it's probably at least 1 log unit above the threshold sensitivity, right? We've tried. I mean, I would like to think you should listen to what I say, and then you can ask if does it any of this matter for the particular conclusion, right? It's a good question, but I don't think for what we are trying to do that's going to be a particular. So in other words, as long as you're taking a slice of the overall information, knowing that we don't have some of this, can we make something out of what we actually get? Is the point here? So. Say that again. It would be great to find it for sure, but to do that experiment for 100 odorants, 200 odorants, would probably take me 5 years, minimum. So other people have done it, because how do you make the animal tell you what the threshold is? It responds wise, but that doesn't tell you the animal's threshold, right? I mean, she was worried about animal, because we're looking at 10% of the glomeruli in the animal. So what if there are other glomeruli that we're not looking at? which have a much lower threshold. So. For that glomerulus. But is that the important thing? No, I'm not sure I understand. You can certainly do that for glomeruli. So we're not. Yeah. Okay. That's a threshold for what? That's a threshold for that glomerulus. But why is that an important measure? So let's draw this here. So you're saying for each glomerulus, if I have a, let's say this is log of the concentration. This is the response. Your point is that okay, it's going to be something like this. You want to find something here, right? For different glomeruli, it's going to be different, right? Okay, I find, let's say I do this, but what would that achieve? Why would I want to do that? I'm not sure I understand why. They don't. I mean, they.
Concentration is independent. It is orthogonal.
To what? This is, every glomerulus has this response, so I don't understand what the worry is. Every glomerulus, you would worry if this looks something like this, right? But it's not. Every, as far as we can tell, every, so you're picking, so the worry only would be if you're in some saturating regime for many of the glomeruli, right? But that's, but it's still a predictable thing. So I don't, in some sense, yeah, I see the point. So the question is that if you do this, does it matter that I'm, if I'm freely moving here, would that change something? And I don't think so. You should listen to what I'm saying, but I think it's a good point, but I don't think so. Yeah.
The question is how much, I guess, interglomeruli from the patient, the high concentration.
But there is hardly any interglomeruli because we're looking at the inputs of the synapse. We're talking about the input coming to the glomerulus. If you go further down, you're quite right. You should worry about that. Yeah. I think there probably is, especially if the particular receptor bound to the previous ligand and then you're not waiting long enough. But we give actually a minute between trials to help that. If there's adaptation in longer time scales, we can't help. So, yeah, we would, at least the immediate receptor adaptation we're getting rid of. So, yeah. Yeah. There is no dynamics yet, no. Yeah, and also this, it's not because we have it and we threw it away, because this probe is very slow. We just don't have anything. We really have to do some other different kind of a probe to get that. Yep. Yes, correct. Except maybe there's like 2 to 3% that are overlapping a little bit, but they are effectively, that's right, correct. That's a good point. Yeah. So the point is that I think empirically, I think we probably should do a different concentration to make sure whatever conclusion we did, and we have done that, not exhaustively, we've done that. But the point simply is that this, if you, for a particular concentration of a particular order, even though for a given order that might sit wherever it wants to in this graph, a given glomerulus is presumably always going to do the same thing. So our point is to identify different glomeruli based on the signature. The only trouble would be that somehow, because this order is at one concentration, this order is another concentration, then you know, you're actually changing the shape of this vector. And for most orderants, we're not close to saturation here. So maybe that's a better way of answering that. In other words, for almost every order we use, for example, this one, if I give higher concentration, there's room for this to grow. So we're not close to saturation for most of the orders. I don't know for all of the orders, right? The main point is that this vector of responses was unique enough to identify individual glomeruli across hemispheres and across animals. That was the only point for this particular thing, because we want to say, a given glomerulus, ideally you want to identify genetically, but it's hard to tag more than 2 or 3 receptors. So we're trying to say, if you take the functional signature of this, can you now repeatedly identify across different animals and different glomeruli? Yep. We can say something, but I don't know if we can say any. We haven't looked at it exhaustively, but other people have tried to do this. But it's something I think we can probably, I should talk to you about more, you know, directly, because it's something we've thought of, but I can't say anything sensible about it now. So, yeah. There is evidence But the debate has been, for humans, this is, it's easiest to do in humans. What debate, I think, is when a particular molecule, as it changes the concentration, it smells something and then it changes quality, how frequently that happens. And people who want to say that it's really concentration dependent pick, I think, the small fraction of the ones that do change that. But I think a vast majority of them, until you go to crazy concentrations, the quality actually is pretty similar, right? So, but I don't know the answer really what fraction of them, but there certainly are examples where you can take a particular odorant, move it along the concentration, the quality seems to change. Right? But I don't think it's that frequent. So. Okay, so the person actually who, and you probably already know if you know the fraction, so Noam Sobel has been actually doing a lot of human psychophysics now on this, and I think he's the one I've talked to extensively, and he thinks that, you know, from all his human psychophysics evidence, that maybe it's overplayed, this idea that as you change the concentration, things really go crazy at some point. Okay, so glomeruli can be uniquely tagged by the odor response spectrum. I mean, I can call it odor tuning, but the olfactory field actually beat me up for it when we called it. So they wanted us to call something else because what is tuning? So we call it odor response spectra. So you have the two glomeruli. This is a particular odor. You can then, simple thing you can do is that you can then fold this over, just sort of flip it and ask, actually, let me get to that. Flip it and then superimpose the two. And in this drawing, what we've done is that we've taken this big glomerulus here and basically anchored that just in space and then ask, okay, how do you match these up? I mean, the green is on one side and red is on the other side. If you just anchor one point, it looks like, you know, there's a little bit of messiness. You don't know who belongs to who. And the point here is that if you just do a simple, you know, cross-correlation of the vectors in the odor response spectra, you can then pick up functionally matching glomeruli. And these are examples of six of these where the odor response spectra are like incredibly, you know, well matched. Right? So if you now look in space here, you can say, okay, this glomerulus and that side looks like this functionally, and that's the separation, and so on and so forth. But of course, just anchoring on any arbitrary one is wrong. So you have to really do something more general. And of course, the simplest thing was just to flip it around, move it around to do the best cross-correlation of all the glomeruli. So you would just do a least squares fit of all the glomeruli based on the functional response, and then ask what is their positional jitter here. Gord, you had a question? And the time scale we're talking about, not at all, because we give these odors for 10 seconds, and the anesthetized animals have taken 10 or 20 sniffs by then, so it's kind of all integrated. Though, with this probe, things behave reasonably. They kind of add up. But if you now go to other probes, certainly postsynaptic, there's lots and lots of dynamics. And I think I won't get to that. It doesn't matter. But there is actually quite a lot of interest in the dynamics of the responses at the spike level. And that varies substantially for all the glomeruli. So, yeah. Okay? So the point here is that we use the functional tag to then identify, this is just one question, how precisely are the individual glomeruli placed? Is it just, is some self-organization that happens with the glomeruli congeal, and there's a lot of error developmentally because it's a complicated problem, what happens? And the answer is that's not true. The glomerular positions are quite precise. So these are two, you know, left and right hemispheres where the color code is basically for functionally similar glomeruli identified using this just cross-correlation. Right? And then these, if you now do the least squares fit of this, when I flip it over and do the least squares fit, these arrows represent the displacement of the matching glomeruli. And you can see across there, there's sort of jitter all over the place. You can anchor them at the center, and the displacements don't seem to have any preferred direction. They're kind of jittering along all the different directions. I don't think this is the fact that these seem to be bigger arrows. This is not systematic in this particular example. This happened. But in general, you can then do a RMS displacement of this, and that, actually, before that, you can actually do a distribution of the displacement. So what's plotted here is this jitter in, you know, we've somewhat arbitrarily picked an AP, anterior posterior, and a medial lateral axis. Ideally, you want to do it for all the different angles, but, you know, we don't have enough data. We just picked AP and the ML axis. And this was not random. It turned out when we kept staring at it, it always looks like it's a little bit more elongated in this direction compared to this. And if you look at the displacements, first of all, the nice thing is it's symmetric, so there is no preferred, you know, going this way or this way. But there is, in the anterior posterior direction, there seems to be a slightly more jitter in this direction compared to this thing. But the main point is, if you look at the standard deviation, these numbers are basically close to the diameter of the glomerulus. So the jitter in this is essentially about one multiple of the glomerular diameter. So there's local jitter of the glomerular position, but it's no more than about one glomerulus on average. So it's, I think this gives you a specific number for what the position of the glomeruli is. By itself, it doesn't mean anything. It just tells you about the development, how well these glomeruli are placed. And these two, I believe, are for rats and mice. That's why I forgot. We did this both for rats and mice. And No, sorry, I apologize. This is for interhemisphere displacement in the same animal, and this is inter-animal variability. And the point is that they're very, very similar. Okay, and this is actually published last year. So then we can go do some prototype maps for, if we identify the most reliably identifiable glomeruli. It's not all of them, unfortunately. I think there's a lot of experimental noise. But the ones that we can reliably identify across at least three different animals, you can make a map. Okay, this has essentially a genetic tag, except it's in functional space now, right? And it's just nice to see that things are very well positioned. In the future, if one were interested, you could go and pick this glomerulus based on its order response, pull it out, and maybe sequence its particular receptor if you really care to do something with it. Okay, but here comes the second part of this. So the precision is interesting, but whatever. And also, I have to say for the aficionados that the APML, the anterior, posterior, and the medial lateral difference probably has a genetic basis, because the way Sakano's work, again, says that the way in which the glomeruli are developing in this direction depends on different kind of molecular cues compared to the other direction. So you could imagine that this is the precision of a particular kind of mechanism versus the other mechanism. Yeah? Yes, that was this drawing, actually. Oh, the actual number. It's a good question, actually. I don't know. That's a good question. Yeah, I have a feeling that the across animals is going to be a little bit worse because, it's different experiments, right? Between hemispheres, everything is the same, so the experimental variability would cancel out. And so it's a good point, and I don't know. Yeah? Yes and no. So Stuart Firestein is the one who did exhaustively. He took a particular receptor, I don't remember that, and he tried many different ligands and tried to mutate different residues. And I think here's what, it's not my data, based on all the things that are available, here's what people think. It's a GPCR, so the ligand binding is thought to be many weakly cooperative interactions across all the seven transmembrane domains. So there's not one residue, it's distributed all over the place, right? So that makes it difficult. If you diddle a little bit, you can go, right? But the position of that receptor in the glomerulus is also dependent on the sequence, but there are other variables. For example, you can take the same sequence and put it in a different genomic locus, and it'll go to a different place. So the ligand specificity is only dependent on the receptor, but the position is dependent on the receptor and something else. So it's hard to imagine evolutionarily how you can keep those two really. And I think of, maybe it's a cheesy analogy, one of them is sort of a two-dimensional diffusion. The position is sort of jitter and two-dimensional, whereas the ligand specificity is multidimensional. It can drift any way, which way it wants. So, yeah. The similarity in the molecules for many things do relate to the perceptual. Like, for example, things that are very similar do smell similar. But the problem is there are always many exceptions. There are the things which look wildly different, which smell the same, are things that look very similar. And it really is a quantitative question, like what fraction of them are the same. But in general, I think there are similarities. Oh, the response is one glomerulus. No, if you look, no. That's the problem. So it's not. So if you look at this, actually, let's just look at this, right? If I say this order and this order, you could have wildly different, just the way it looks. Yeah. But similarity in what, though? I think this has been also exhaustively analyzed by one of Noam Sobel's students, where they took basically chemical tables. So apparently there are programs which give you something like 10,000 parameters of a chemical, right? As you can imagine, right? And you can then try to do some sort of a PCA clustering, whatnot, and it's not easy. In the end, there was a paper that published, in the end came up with two axes. Is it pleasant or unpleasant? But I don't know, it's not very satisfying in the end. Yeah. So this, for example, what is this distance compared to the size of the factor bulb? It's I think 1 in 1,000 or something. The precision is about 0.1% of the bulb. I think it's pretty amazing. So. Compare what between the different orders? Glomeruli. No, this is not one order, right? This is across all the orders. So each glomerulus has a vector of responses to all the odorants. So we're not picking any one odorant, right? You see? Yeah. In fact, that's how we pick. If it's just one order, we wouldn't be able to do this. It has to be a diverse set of, yeah? Okay, so what about testing this chematopic? And then there's the kind of classes. And then what we can do, of course, is since we're only imaging this part of the like 1/10 of the glomerulus, we can look at the fine scale diversity, not this broad scale thing. So the short answer was we didn't find anything. So if you look at the separation of glomeruli and their similarity, and this is basically a two-dimensional histogram where like, you know, the density refers to how many glomeruli we had across all the different animals, right? So it turned out that if you just do this projection, this axis, this is mean or median, I don't remember which is which, that as a function of the separation, at least up to 2 millimeters, the similarity more or less is flat. Yet there's a slight excess here, but more or less flat, which is different. If this was some sort of a retinotopic map, you would have seen a clear fall off with distance. And we don't see this, at least for this distance. And you know, you can also do the projection in the other direction, which is also not significantly different. But this is one way of looking at it. And we think that there is the separation between glomeruli doesn't predict how similar they are. So as far if they're far away, they're just as similar or dissimilar. Another way you can do is that you can take the response, this is the vector of responses, and ask if you can predict the position of that glomerulus, you know, the x and y, as some sort of a least squares fit to all the different odorants. So in other words, you would basically try to do a least squares fit where you would guess x based on all the response vectors, and you would then, of course, estimate the coefficients. If you do this, this is what we saw. So as a function of the real anterior, so there would be a real position and the predicted position, right, for all the different glomeruli, there is a weak trend here, right? There's a trend, I shouldn't quantify. There is a trend, right? In other words, by knowing the odor response spectra of all of the glomeruli, you can then make a guess as to where approximately they might be, right? However, this dashed line tells you the precision of the positioning of individual glomeruli. So if you compare to how precisely a glomerulus is placed, the mouse goes into great trouble to put a glomerulus in a particular position, but yet the predictability of that position based on the odor is much, much more scattered compared to that. So, just given, and you can make the conclusion whether it is meaningful or not, but the idea is that how well can you predict the position of the glomerulus based on the odor response? It's much worse than how well you can predict based on its genetic tag. Right? That would be the point here. So, yeah?
If you think about natural odors, they're probably a mix of many, many molecules.
Yeah. It would be a great thing to test, but I don't know how to start. What, like, I don't know if horse and cat, right? I mean, people do, you know, fox urine, this and that. And I think the trouble is really, I don't think we have a very good sense of what natural order is. It all sounds good qualitatively, but when it comes down to picking, I don't know how to fine-tune it down. There just seems to be already too many. But you could do, for example, you could just bite the bullet and take 50 different odors, mixed odors. And my guess would be you're not going to see anything with this kind of analysis, right? Because we already have mixtures, by the way, in our analysis. Yeah, but there are mixtures that are pleasant to humans because my lab people wanted, if you look at the list, there's lavender oil and orange oil and so on. So, yeah.
Isn't that
mixture
actually, if we
do odor along with it's a big question. There is, you can find nonlinearities. Again, it's a quantitative question, how nonlinear it is. And we don't know the answer fully yet. Okay, yeah, Tim.
What about the order of I guess, a mouse, the cage made for a different mouse or something like that? Those types of things.
Sure. Sure, but how would I isolate that?
No, I mean, you can compare
No, no, how would I get that odor to give it to the animal in a controlled way, right? Yeah, I think now the point is it's a very good point, but it's hard to know because you have to
need some kind of, you know, the bedding and then
release the... Sure, sure. This has all been done and there's no... So, there is a way to do it, but I think it's... Then how would you prove that what you obtained is really the... is what it smells, right? So you could do the experiment, but I just don't know if you don't find anything, somebody else will come and say you just didn't do the right thing and therefore you didn't find it, right? Yeah. But it's not clear that it's the main olfactory system anyway, right? It could be the pheromone system.
Yeah.
So this is the main.
Yeah.
Yeah. We don't know. So we haven't done the maps with the mixture. At the level of the inputs, there is very strong evidence that mixing is linear, with saturation, of course, right? But it's not entirely clear. In other words, there is some slight evidence that certain ligands can actually antagonize the binding of one. Then you would get a funny... No, you won't get a sum, right? So, but we are looking at inputs. That is exactly right. So we can sort of wave our hands and say probably things are okay so far. Yeah, but it's a good. But the thing is that, as you can imagine, combinatorially, it's getting crazy. Like when you have 100 orders to mix all the pairs, what concentration is it? 100, 100, 120, right?
Yeah.
There are a couple of papers which have said, blanking on the French group, I think Michel Chaput, I think they've given they recorded from olfactory nerve, which is very hard to record because they're small, they're like bundled, but you can do it by very tedious ways. Then they basically changed, and I give one order, another order, and change the mixtures, and they find nonlinear interactions and spiking. But my take on reading the papers is that it's not clear if it's predominant or it can happen, right? And so, but it can happen, of course. Yeah. Yep. Yes. At the level of the glomerulus,
yes.
Right. Well, I think, I don't know if I'm answering the question or not, if I'm fully understanding the question, but you can think of the glomerular layout as essentially a lookup table, but the lookup table has no order in it within it, right? It's precise and repeatable. But the neighbors are not predictably, you know, similar or different, right? But somebody has to read that. They're not
overlapping.
I see. So, oh, good point. Yes, that's right. No, I think he means physical sort of leaks. There's no like information coming here doesn't in some physical way leak. Like it's not like axons are kind of slightly going here. There's not. Right, right. I think at the level of the input, it is precise. This particular axon will come here. It's not that a few axons kind of mistakenly go over there. They don't. At the level of them, they are exactly right. But the things that read those, they actually can sample for multiple glomeruli. In fact, I think that is the point. That they can integrate across different. Even though the primary dendrite goes in here, as I'd say, I can give you the bottom line of the next part of the talk, that even though the primary glomeruli goes to the central glomerulus and very unleakily samples that, the lateral dendrites can sample the other space here within the glomerulus, and you do integrate information that way. So I think, I'm not sure if I'm answering the question, but I don't think there's any inconsistency here. Yeah, that's a great question. I think that's part of what we're actually doing. So you for output of what though, right? The mitral cells are leaving. So if you want to look at the mitral cells, the difficulty there, and which comes to the next point, is that there is not one physical place where you can just look at all of them. You have to really do cellular resolution imaging. And in fact, that's what we're doing now. So. Okay, so. it's a great lead in. I think it was like, I didn't plant Rob here. So the transformation of the order inputs were done. I think the one study that just came out this month in Nature Neuroscience, so I think if I rush through it, and if you're interested, you could certainly look it up. So mapping the circuitry within here, so for example, what does this mitral cell know? Does it just, you know, do simple signal averaging and then sends out, or is it compressing the dynamic range, whatever, or is it something more complicated or more interesting, perhaps, like it really is reducing redundancy. It's, you know, changing, decorrelating, you know, the multiple mitral cells are becoming decorrelated within the body. Those are the questions, and these are not new. People are obsessed about this in other physical systems, sensory systems, for a long time. And I think we have now, we have tools to actually address this in the olfactory system. So the one technical advance we made was that using odors to activate these guys is, of course, the natural way to do it. But as all the questions illustrate here, that there are a lot of complications. So if you're just interested in the input-output transform, perhaps there's something to be gained by directly activating each glomerulus at will, essentially, right? So that's what we thought. And so we basically made a mouse in which all the sensory axons, I should go back here, all the sensory axons, neurons, express channel rhodopsin, the light-activated cation channels, which I think everybody here knows, right? So the channel rhodopsin now is, we made a this is a transgenic mouse. And so here's an example. I don't need to dim the lights. You can sort of see it's hooked to YFP. So all the glomeruli, which show the termini of the axons, they all are labeled with channel rhodopsin. It turns out that the pheromone system, this accessory olfactory bulb, is highly labeled. So, you know, it's also useful for studying the pheromone system. And this works as advertised. You can take a brain slice, keep it living, patch onto a single mitral cell. This is the mitral cell layer. And then you can do sort of point scanning and shine light on individual spots and measure the synaptic currents. Because you're stimulating the inputs, you should be able to measure synaptic currents. And if you do this, you know, you can see very robust synaptic currents at three different locations, all blocked by glutamate receptor blockers. This is what you would expect. So essentially, if you shine light on the terminals, it releases action potentials, releases transmitter, activates the mitral cell. And then you can actually go one further. You can fill this cell, reconstructs its dendritic tuft. And you can see that the spots, when you shine light on particular spots, the places where you get maximum current, as indicated by this color scale, is exactly where you would expect where the dendritic tuft is actually receiving the inputs. Yeah? That's actually, it's a good eye. This is actually hand marked, so I don't think this is correct. So we have, I apologize. So we have it, but this is, I don't think this is the delay. So there is a delay because you have to charge the axons up to threshold and so on, right? So this is all just proof of principle that it is working as advertised, and those are just the currents. And so this, then the in vivo experiments of recording odor responses from mitral cells was done actually by my the former student who was in my lab, who is now his own lab, and this amazing graduate student from Bangalore, actually, who came for just for a year and a half to work with Florin and got all of this stuff done. The mice were originally made in my lab, and we've been doing other stuff, and the stuff that I'm going to show were done in Florin's lab, in Cold Spring Harbor lab. So the idea was simple. So you cannibalize an overhead projector, cannibalize a projector, DLP projector, actually, which is this digital micro mirror device, and remove the filters, the color wheels, and so on. So you can actually shine specific pixels at about, I think it's 3 times the video rate or something, because the video rate includes the wheels. So with about 15 millisecond resolution, you can go even better if you actually get the original programmer's kit. But, you know, about with 15 millisecond precision, you can shine light on any arbitrary spot. Of course, you can create patterns. Initially, what they did was they projected onto the surface of the bulb, put in electrodes, and they chose to put dual tetrodes to just get more neurons at once. And then you just, you know, shine individually, and essentially like you would do in a retina, right? Visual system, you know, some sort of a random dot kind of a thing. And if you shine, these are the four tetrode channels, get some spontaneous activity. This is actually the same cell, as you can see. Then when you shine light here, you get an increased spike. So this is the number of trials, time. When the light is on, you get increased firing. So you're presumably driving the input glomerulus, and the mitral cell is firing, right? And I think they made this beautiful video just to give you a sense, and just for, I think, comic relief, maybe I should show this. But it doesn't work. Okay, sorry. No, I think it's not working here, too. I think there's some funny video thing that I can show you. It's very, you know, it just shows the whole process where, you know, you shine, you know, it's automatically sent to different points, and you can build up a glomerular receptive field. Yeah. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Yes. Yep. That's right. Yes. Yes. Sure. Yep. Yep. Great. So, what is the point of doing this, right? Yep. Yep. That's right. So this. But that's exactly the point. So we're not. We're using this technique for this study only to identify the mitral cells that are receiving input from the single glomerulus. It's purely an identification strategy. Then we switch the orders, as I'll say. But in the future, to answer your question, you could use this method to ask questions about, for example, time coding. So with orders, if people say, okay, is exactly when the order arrives with respect to the sniff, does that matter to the mouse? I mean, that's very hard to do it with odorants. You can then use light and say, if I give the light, if I shine it at different times after the sniff is initiated, will the mouse now perceive those as different odors, same odor, right? So maybe it's asking the capacity of the system, maybe not how it normally works. At least you can push it to do that, yeah? Short axon neurons, short axon cells, yeah. We haven't exhausted. It's a great question. So your question, another way of asking more generally, is that do you see interactions across different spots? And I think we're just beginning to do that. The difficulty is to tease apart, when you're recording from mitral cells, to tease apart contributions. If you see an effect of shining light here, we don't know if that's coming through the glomerular network or the deeper network, right? So that's the difficulty here, because both are thought to come into play. But it's a very important question, of course, right? But the effective interglomerular effect at the glomerular level is thought to be inhibition. There's very little evidence there's excitatory crosstalk at the glomerular level, so far anyway. So. Oh, but you can spread it out, right? You're not shining light on the same. Let's go back here. You're worrying here if I do, like, you know, and you can, of course, slow it down if you want, right? Because you're deciding what to do. You could do multiple points, but then it becomes combinatorial, and you have to do this sensibly. So right now, for this study, it was simply used to identify so-called sister mitral cells going to the same glomerulus versus different. That's all. We could have done this anatomically. If there is a better way of doing this anatomically, we could have done it, but there isn't an easy way. So the very specific question here is that if I have two mitral cells that are receiving the central input from the same glomerulus, are they completely redundant, or are they doing something different? That's really the motivation in this case. Yep. Okay, so you can build this glomerular receptive field. So for a particular mitral cell, the hot spots are essentially increased firing, and you can smooth it. The one very important control we had to do was to turn down the intensity of light to make sure that the spot stays the same, because remember, there are axons of passage which are diving in, and you could sort of stimulate somewhere here, and if it makes the synapse here, then you know, you'll fool yourself. So this is one of the controls where as you turn the intensity of the light down, the spiking rate goes down because you're exciting it less, but the position sort of stays the same, right? This, and then we did some reconstructions, two-photon reconstructions. When you find a mitral cell with a receptive field here, is there really a glomerulus there in that boundary, and so on. So although we are not 100% certain, we are, 99% certain that when we see something like this, that mitral cell is receiving the central input from that glomerulus, okay? More importantly, if you have two mitral cells which send their tufts to a single glomerulus, you will then find their receptive fields to be the same, the light receptive fields. And here is an example for two cells, which we call sisters because their receptive field is the same for the different intensity. If they're non-sisters, if you will, they would then have different positions, right? In this case, neighboring glomeruli, okay? That's all we use to answer your question, Sarah. So this is for this study, this is the only reason to use the channel rhodopsin. It's just a simple way of identifying cells which, and this is important because you cannot stick an electrode and pick two cells and assume that they go into the same glomerulus, because there's a cone over which they spread out, and neighboring mitral cells we know from anatomy can actually come from different glomeruli. No, it seems to vary a little bit on, this is something, I don't want to push it under the rug, but the expression level of different glomeruli are actually, the channel redox is a little bit different. So, so if you look here, right, this is not as broad. So the light intensity for a given intensity, if they have more channel rhodopsin, just endogenously, they'll have a lower threshold, right? So. In this case, tetraoid, we have no idea, right? This extracellular recording. But I just finished saying that sister cells, all the mitral cells that go to one glomerulus are not exactly next to each other. They actually have a radius. There's a cone of about 20 degrees. So if you take a particular region, only something like 10 to 20% of the cells are going to the same glomerulus. In fact, even smaller within that region. So it's very common to find non-sister cells next to each other, physically. Okay. It's just anatomy. There's nothing magic. It's just the way it is, right? It's not that the mitral cells are descending down in a perfect column. They're not. Okay, so now comes the order response. So this is sort of in air. Spontaneously, the cells tend to fire. And this is, we measure the respiration, of course. So if you different trials, you know, they're sort of spiking along this particular cell. When you present odor, something happened and you stop it, right? If you now look, in nothing major, if you do the time histogram, spike rate, spikes per bin, as time, and it's maybe a slight drop. But if you look at the responses with respect to the sniff, in air, they're kind of firing at the inspirations. They're going pr, pr. But when the odor comes in, look, they're inhibited, but there's also a delay with respect to the input, right? So there's two measures here. One is the average firing rate, but there's also the phase response. And you can do this by just plotting this respiratory phase. Because this is anesthetized, we just ignore time and we just say 0 to 2 pi. The period does change a little bit, but we're ignoring it. In awake condition, this is, you cannot do this because time, sniff times vary quite wildly, right? So if you plot 0 to 2 pi, each spike is plotted in time as well as in phase. You can see that in air, it's firing here. When odor comes along, it switches dramatically the phase and then, you know, it comes back. If you project this way, you get this time histogram. If you project it this way, you get what we call a phase response, you know, phase tuning curve, I guess is what we call it. So at 0 to 2 pi, you have maximum firing in air is here. And then in odor, it shifts to over there. And we just show it normalized just to see the position, I guess. So now, OK, that's for one order. So if you now pick two different units from the same tetraode, this is an odor called PNAS aldehyde, which shows a beautiful increase in firing rate for both the neurons. And the phase, you know, basically you have some phase preference in spontaneously. When the odor comes in, you know, everything goes to hell. They fire everywhere. And it's interesting to see that the firing actually persists past the right? And I don't know what the explanation is, but that's what happens, right? Yeah. Yep. Yep. Yep.
So what if the order that you put in does not excite glomeruli in that receptor? How do you know that that mitral cell is going to the pod? The order has a code for the receptor, and you don't know if that order.
But I don't care. I don't care. I only care that the light mapping was done simply to say these are two mitral cells which are getting central input from the one glomerulus. Because the field, maybe I have to back up. In the field, in the olfactory field, the mitral cells are generally thought of as relaying the information they get from this single glomerulus and send it off, right? So our question is, if I identify two mitral cells which are getting input from the same glomerulus, they should give the same information to the brain, according to this previous theory, right? So I somewhat don't care in this case, although it would be interesting to know how that mitral cell is excited by that or not, right? But it's hard to imagine where, how else it would be excited, because a mitral cell gets no other excitatory response. I know. Oh, so in the space. Oh, yeah, yeah. We've picked the dorsal cell. Statistically, yes. I have picked 40 odors. Yeah, 40 odors, which we just try. Exactly. Okay. Yeah. Yes.
Okay.
I'm not sure I understand. So we have renormalized, so every sniff is its own chunk, right? So we basically 0 to 2 pi is start of this sniff and then this sniff. So you're saying just use the very first sniff as the anchor.
Just the beginning of the sniff as the anchor, but don't scale the time relative to the length.
Very little difference in this particular case, because the breathing is very regular. Right? You can actually see it here, right? This is the anesthetized animal. In this case, it doesn't. We did it very preliminarily, but we just said like it's not much different, just because this is very periodic in general, right? But in the awake condition, this becomes, of course, very important. What I thought you were going to ask is that we've collapsed everything into one, right? Does it matter in time, the first sniff versus the second sniff? And right, there's a different question. Even that doesn't seem to in the anesthetized case, so which is sad, but. And actually, I'll show you another piece of data at the very end from now, which it has. Result in today's actually this week's Neuron, which actually addresses a little bit, saying that this is important, the timing. So okay, but I think hopefully it's clear now. So we pick in a certain orders which we will guess would run, and then we just try. It's not that we tested 40 orders. It's not that all of them will activate any particular mitral cell, but we just have chosen cleverly, so statistically you will get a few, right? So different order, these two cells now actually respond slightly differently. Right. These are sister cells getting the same excited input. This one increases a little bit. This one decreases. Right? And then yet another odor. This is, I think, now this is an aldehyde, and this is a ketone increase, and it's kind of increase. But you know, I can show you many examples. This is sort of staring at tea leaves. You have to really analyze this. Right? So if you do this now, so for each, so let's focus on the firing rate. So if I now just focus on the firing rate, for a pair of cells, I just measure the average firing rate, again, ignoring the time dimension, just the average firing rate, perisimilus time histogram during the order period. Average firing rate over many seconds. Each order, for each unit, there's a number, right? So you have a vector of order responses, just the firing rate, for the pair of cells. Now, these are classified as sister cells based on the light mapping, right? As you can visually see, the different pairs, the firing rates are highly correlated, right? And no surprise, it would have been nice. Occasionally, you can see differences. And we think, again, you know, it's a matter of what do you look at, right? I mean, on average, they're highly correlated. You can find some slight differences, which I'm unable to explain. And then if you look at non-sister mitral cells, you know, thankfully, they're not very similar to each other, right? This one, right? That is exactly this arrow here, excited, inhibited. So. Not very often. So this gives you a statistic, right? I've shown the arrow. So out of the 40 times 3, right, we see about, you know, 4. That, so it's, I think, about 1 or 2%, I would say. 5% maybe, maximum. Yep.
When you have sister cells, for example,
yeah?
Based on
the definition, based on activity of one. No. We have a glomeruloreceptive field for each cell. So this would be a non-sister cell. So we know that one of the cells gets activated with this glomerulus, the other cell, a neighboring glomerulus. So I don't, we know for each. We're only picking ones where we can find. So we're doing the experiment. We only take pairs of cells for which we get receptive fields, the glomerular receptive fields. For each cell, we would independently find their hotspots, and then later on we'll say, are the hotspots the same location or a different location? Does that make sense? So every, okay. No. There, anything going below is negative, right? There's one here. Mitral cell, yeah, at the level of the glomerulus. Oh, no. Our data is unable to say that because we're not going to be able to detect negative very well because it requires spontaneous activity. But other people have shown that there's very little in mouse and rat, although that doesn't mean that they don't exist. People haven't seen them.
Okay.
So this is non-sister cells are not correlated. So the firing rate, they're correlated for sister cells. And this correlation now, is it high or low? We can say that by doing self-correlation. You can divide the trials of the same cell, you know, to chunk the two trials and say how correlated they are. And that average is about the same. So in other words, the sister mitral cells are just about as correlated in firing rate as they could be given our experimental limitations. Non-sister cells are somewhat correlated, and this we think has to do with our choice of odorants, because we picked odorants that activate the dorsal surface, so you actually induce a little, in a small degree of correlation. So, but it's significantly different. This is unsurprising. All the people who would think of as a relay would say, of course, well, what do you expect? They're getting input from the same thing. But of course, I wouldn't be talking about this unless there was something hopefully more interesting. When we started looking at the phase tuning, so if you look at, in air, these two cells are firing in the same phase. They're kind of firing in the rest, you know, in the inspiration. When the odor comes, this guy is more or less in the same location, whereas this one changed its phase to fire more here, right? And you can create what we call a phase response, where we correlate this with this. So in other words, the odor phase tuning, correlate that with this. This would be highly correlated. So you would get a number close to one. If there's a change like this, this is a response, right? You would get a downward dip. So you would decrease your correlation. So the more downward dip there is, the more phase responding it is, right? The two sister cells, as you can see, are, as far as we can tell, completely unrelated, right? So this cell changes its phase dramatically for some odors, and this guy does too, but they're not necessarily doing it for the same ones, right? But of course, now we have to do a correlation. If you do the correlation across all the odors, all the sister cells, we find that the phase correlation, the way in which cells change the phase, is not very correlated, whether they are sister or non-sister. This is not simply because it's completely, every trial is completely random, because if you do the self-correlation across trials, that is highly correlated. So a given cell reliably responds by changing its phase over and over the same way, but its sister cell does it in a different way. Okay, so, and then just for comparison, you see that the firing rate, of course, is very highly correlated. And I'm going to just mention it. You can, of course, do the more straightforward, just cross-correlation of the two sister cells. And we see that in the air period, the sister cells are highly correlated. They're sort of firing in spike timing very similarly. This kind of a shape is because of the respiration, right? There's an induced periodicity. But when the odor comes in, they actually reduce the correlation, as you would expect if their phases are randomly moved around. Okay? And that's also true for the average data. The bottom line is simply that this is what we think. So when the odor comes along, sister cells, in spontaneously, they're being just driven by the glomerulus at a lower rate, and they're kind of going together. But when the odor comes along, they change their firing rate, but they also importantly change the time in which they spike. But this change for sister cells the change in one cell does not predict where the other cell is going to go, right? And so you can imagine in the extreme, although we haven't proven this, that there is at least, you know, two ways in which this can send information. One is just sort of average firing. If the downstream and a reader is sitting there looking at just the overall firing rate, the sister cells are essentially redundant. But if it's sensitive to the timing of the spike, then, you know, they're actually carrying independent information. Yeah. That's a good point. So that's not the case here. It's not the case because you can do this in two different ways. One, if you shine light directly on that glomerulus, which, you know, Sarah didn't like, but if you use that, then they continue to fire in the same place. So it's not the intrinsic property. This is a very good point. It's not, right? The other way you can do is that you can actually infuse GABA antagonists into the bulb, which is a dirty experiment, and then you can now reduce this phase separation, essentially. So you can bring them back more close to, right? And the idea is that the central excitatory drive for the sister cells is coming from the excitatory input in the center, but of course they're sampling laterally, they're sampling inhibition coming from other glomeruli. So if they are independent, where they go for the sister cells is independent, then a given order, for example, the blue order will activate the central glomerulus and these side glomeruli and would influence this sister cell in some way. But since the lateral endites here are not going anywhere near there, maybe the red cell is not being influenced by all the other ones. Whereas the red cell would have its own lateral receptive field, effectively. And if they're independent, then you could, in principle, we haven't shown it in practice, you can principally explain this. Yeah. Tim, any question?
Yeah.
I can actually stop here, by the way. So I'm done the third part, I'm going to completely skip, and this is it. So thanks.
Yeah. So the sisters respond to the same odor, but there's
different information potentially in their spike training.
Right.
Have you looked at cells that are not sisters and then just looked at trials where they respond to their like favorite odor and then ask, or is there a bigger difference between non-sisters that respond to anything than the sister responses? We expect some heterogeneity in anything, I guess.
I'm not sure I understand. So if this data says that the non-sister cells are not related to any, you're saying that in this group, take ones which have very high correlation.
Yeah, take the trials, give the non-sister their odor, they like
the commonly like some odor. So the increase of firing rate the same way, they're just as uncorrelated in phase. But why would that not be?
Well, I'm just wondering if the differences in firing patterns between sisters, is that just expected variability because the...
But it's not variability, right? It's repeatable. So I think it's a fundamental difference. You can argue whether this means something, but it's not variability because from trial to trial, they do the same thing, right? That's this point. So the phase, the way in which they change the phase for a given order is not random. It's predictable. For that order, if you give me this order, I can tell you where it goes. So that's... But you can say that that's a consequence of the circuit, but that's fine. But it's still a predictable consequence of that circuit. So all we can say is that there's information. The question of whether this is variability which nobody else cares, I don't know. I think so. I think you can, maybe the extreme version of this is that you don't have to worry about space at all, in a way. You can look at the mitral cell, and you can basically look at the timing, which of course also has a firing rate, right? Because you're looking at multiple spikes coming. So that's, in other words, you have to care about when it spikes. You cannot course average it. You have to really look at the some, you know, in fact, the next slide was going to be this stuff from Uchida's lab, which says that the scale on which behaviorally it's relevant in terms of SNF isn't about 20 milliseconds, is what they come up with.
But
so.
Right.
Sure. Of course. But the thing, the reason that. Correct. But you can think of the mitral cell converting that space into just identity, because all now matters is where this guy goes. It's the identity of the cell now. So, yeah. We don't know if. Sorry, say that again. So,
The first part you were showing the spectrum of a response for a panel of odors.
Yep.
If you compared the panel of odors with the input with the panel of responses for the mitral cell output.
No, we're in the process. So, do it. Yes, of course. Yes. Yeah.
Okay.
Mm-hmm. Yes, yeah, given there's thought to be about 12.
What's the reason of this sort of non-random variability?
No.
The reason why you have different findings is because they do receive input from more than one system, therefore they have more.
Correct.
Yeah.
I understand the sister pair. Yes, it's inhibitory, that's the point. Yeah, do you say?
That's why you said when you put down.
Correct. So the idea would be, and we haven't proven this biophysically, but the idea would be that you think of a integrated fire kind of a neuron. It's getting a DC input, and the inhibition coming in laterally is sculpting out when it's going to spike. So that's.
So the real information, I'm guessing you want, with bias.
Yep. Absolutely. Absolutely. Across odors. Exactly. Exactly. No, you want to do the retina style experiment here with all the mitral cells, and I think, you know, exactly. Yeah.
This idea of a phase mode
put it around like a threshold and change the duration?
We haven't, but I think.
And they don't see it in both phase.
Yeah. So I think I cannot disambiguate space from time because we've sort of assumed that it's all uniform, right? And this is why I think it's very important. I think I would. This is a very nice paper, and it really shows that, you know, if you have, so this is when the odor comes on, right? This is an awake and a behaving animal. This is a rat, but you know, it's the same thing. So a couple of sniffs, and then really they show that it is the time with the onset of the first sniff. In this case, you know, you can have the same Gilles Laurent style, you know, principal component analysis. You know, you have the population of cells, of course, recorded separately, and for the two odors, the trajectories start diverging in this space very, very quickly. Across population. So they really show that you have to care about this 20, 30 millisecond the time scale. So if you just average across large, you lose a lot more. So, but anyway, this, and also you know, it's complicated to show whether this is important for the perception, right? They try to in their experiments, but at least we know when the animal is really sniffing in real life, the time, the actual time with relation to sniff is really the important one. We are starting to do that. I think that before we do that, we want to actually ask a very specific question because it seems like it's too open if you just try it. But we want to ask very specifically, can you, for example, get nonlinear summation, right? Some sort of a nonlinear effect by simulating one glomerulus with the pair. And if there's preferential glomeruli that activate a given cell, so on. So. There's absolute anatomical proof, the fact that there, all along the lateral dendrites, there's granule cells giving inputs. But the key question really is, along this distance of the mitral cells, whether it's specific, like is there some specificity where the effective synapses, or is it really random? That I think, it would be, exactly. That, this is a very important question we just don't know.
So you are minimal.
Receptor. Well, it's a good question, but I think that because inhibition can affect this, it has to be, I think, a circuit.
Well, somebody could block the inhibitory transmission and see what happens.
No, we've done that experiment, yeah. But not enough to be confident, but we've done two experiments. Yeah. We just put bicuculin on top. You increase the firing rate, unfortunately, so that's a confounding factor. But the changes of the way in which the spikes change now become much more correlated across sister cells.
Right, but regardless of this difference between sister cells, if we would measure the response of factory and receptor
neuron,
yeah. Would they be dynamic,
similar time scale? It's not known. I mean, people have attempted to do this, and there is some idea that I think there's this paper that you might know from Hartwig Spohr's, where they looked at the arrival of times in the glomeruluses in calcium imaging, and then there's predictable delays, like you know, of, I don't remember the exact times, 1500 milliseconds, but it's more the onset. So there is something certainly interesting, but whether or not within the glomerulus, there's heterogeneity of that, like one axon, different axons expressing the same receptor do something completely different in terms of timing and convey that onto the mitral cells. I have a hard time believing, but nobody's shown that that's not true.
A similar question, is there known that there's like flow detectors in the nose that report just the stream of air, some mechanical?
Oh, it's absolutely. So it's not 100% sure, but there's a paper actually by Min-Min Lo and Ming-Hong Ma where they, yeah. As soon as you sniff even air, right? I think it's probably both, but I think, yeah. But how do you know that's not odorants in the air? So yeah, no. But if you just
yeah,
no, they are mechanosensitive. The cilia, it's been shown biophysically that the cilia. In principle, we don't know for sure. What inhibition? Sorry. Divisive inhibition. Yeah, you're talking about Rachel Wilson stuff. I don't know. I think we have to really do those experiments that was done in flies in mice, because I think mouse circuit is different. I know it's a simple way of saying wave your hands, but the fact that, for example, the exact experiment that I showed you, Rachel did by doing paired recordings from principal cells in the fly antenna lobe are absolutely the same. They're like even the individual synaptic inputs, they are entirely redundant as far as we can tell, which is very different from here. The sister mitral cells in the fly are completely redundant. Okay? So the point is that if something which we find very different is there, so the other stuff, the divisive normalization, anything else, there's lateral excitation very strongly in fly. There's no evidence for lateral excitation in the bulb yet. We don't know now. Maybe we'll find it. Yeah. There is supposed to be this divisive overall normalization, and then Tom Cleland has a model where they, I think, I don't remember the exact details, but there is a way in which you can get that in mice. So, yeah, we should.
Okay, so
thank you.
We're going to start up